rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Yes, yesterday it happened. The Democrats finally got a spine. Maybe they'd been renting some old movies. I mean, who knows? Maybe somebody there on the over on the Democratic side of the aisle had gone back and rented Network.
You've got to say, I'm a human being. My life has value.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
There you go. That from back in the day, with that kind of language, would have gotten you an R rating in a movie. Welcome back to our program, my friends, and congratulations to Harry Reid for saying enough. Enough already. And then you had Bill Frist. I mean, Bill Frist just being absolutely, it threw a hissy fit. I don't know how to describe it beyond that. It looked like a hissy fit. All right? It's just, he was just, I've been slapped in the face. You know, with Rick Santorum standing behind him with every hair in place and, you know, his purple shirt and his nice tie and everything. And there's Bill Frist. In fact, my friend Rob Call, who runs opednews.com, he called me up and he said, you got to turn on your TV. He says, Bill Frist. He says, he looks gay. And I said, what's wrong with looking gay? And he said, no, it's Bill Frist. And I'm like, what? And so I go, and he's throwing a hissy fit. I don't know, you know, and he's saying, I've been slapped. This is a slap in the face. And so Harry Reid says, no, the real slap in the face wasn't to you, Bill.
Statements on major news programs, Meet the Press, all kinds of commitments being made, and they simply were not followed through. It's a slap in the face to the American people that this investigation has been stymied, stopped, obstructions thrown up every step of the way. That's the real slap in the face. That's the slap in the face. And today the American people are going to see a little bit of light. On November 14th, we're going to have a phase-by-phase idea of how they're going to complete this. Finally.
Finally, there may be, a little bit of a light here at the end of this tunnel. We'll see. But that's that, Senator Harry Reid. The larger question, our theme for the day, we've been operating off national victimhood and fear for years. Our quote for the day from Voltaire, by the way, men who believe absurdities will commit atrocities. Did Bush scare America into a second term? Is that what happened? This is an absolutely fascinating study that was done at Skidmore College. Sheldon Solomon granted permission to the UFPPC to reprint some of this, how it got onto the web. It's the what they call morality salience. And then using psychobabble, they say a putative psychological effect induced by having experimental subjects think about their own personal death before performing a task. Okay, so in other words, what they did was they asked people to imagine that they, what it would be like when they die, to imagine their own death. And then they had them perform a task. And they say, how does this change their task? And they asked them their opinions of things after they asked them to think about their own death for a moment and noticed how it changed their opinions of things. And this is just absolutely fascinating. It confirms what Goebbels and Hess and Hitler knew and knew so well. And that is that if you scare people, if you get people to actually think about their own death, you not just scare them like, you might stub your toe. No, scare them to the point of thinking about their own death. That they will then be looking for, at that point, they're willing to surrender themselves to an authoritarian power. They did a series of studies on this, on terror, they called it terror management theory. And the the theory, terror management theory, says that heightened concerns about mortality, about your own death, should intensify the appeal of charismatic leaders or of, you know, strongman figures. And so they said, you know, let's check this thing out. And they did a series of studies on this. Study number one explored the role of mortality, of thinking about your own death, concerns in American popular culture, and support for President Bush. And what they found was that mortality salience, in other words, thinking about your own death, increased agreement with favorable assessment of Bush and his policies. Reminding people of their own, the fact that we're all, you know, nobody here gets out alive, as Jim Morrison says. Reminding people of that increased support for George W. Bush. They say in study two, we found that the paralleling the effects of subliminal death primes reported in previous research, subliminal presentations of 9/11 related stimuli increased death thought accessibility. Now, that's psychobabble for, or speak or whatever, for if we can slip 9/11 in, even if it's out of context, if we can slip 9/11 in, it's going to make people more willing to accept policies that have nothing to do with 9/11. So you've got George Bush giving a speech in which he's rationalizing the Iraqi war. He's rationalized. This is before we went into Iraq. And what does he say?
We must also never forget the most vivid events of recent history. On September the 11th, 2001, America felt its vulnerability, even to threats that gather on the other side of the earth.
And then he flips right from that to Iraq. Surprise, surprise.
First, some ask why Iraq is different from other countries or regimes that also have terrible weapons. While there are many dangers in the world, the threat from Iraq stands alone because it gathers the most serious dangers of our age in one place.
Well, it turns out that as we are now discovering, that George W. Bush not only knew that this was not true, that this particular thing was not true, but many of these things were not true. A series of questions that need answering. David Sirota done a great job on this. And throughout the day, I want to come back to these mortality salience studies. In other words, this association of one's own death with willingness to follow an authoritarian leader, a Hitler-like leader, a Stalin-like leader, a Bush-like leader. And people say, oh, wait a minute, this is some kind of, what are you, this is some kind of partisan attack? Are you picking on George W. Bush? You're just picking on Republicans, right? No. No, I'm not. In fact, let's remember how Dwight Eisenhower ran for president. I saw the movie last night, Good Night and Good Luck. You got to see this thing about Edward R. Murrow and Joe McCarthy. And it ends with a clip of Eisenhower. It is incredible. And how Eisenhower ran for president in his first campaign for president, Dwight D. Eisenhower, the Republican, ran for president on a platform of peace. Here's his actual campaign ad, ran coast to coast on all the networks on television.
Eisenhower knows how to deal with the Russians. He has met Europe's leaders, has got them working with us. Elect the number one man for the number one job of our time. November 4th, vote for peace. Vote for Eisenhower.
A paid film.
Now, think about that. Eisenhower's pitch was he's met the leaders of Europe and he's got them working with us. Number one. And number two, November 4th, vote for peace. Vote for Eisenhower. You know, it's just, it's absolutely incredible. Ever since George Romney back in 1968 came back from Vietnam and said, he was the Republican governor of Michigan, came back from Vietnam and said, I was brainwashed. And then went down in flames politically. And then George McGovern lost the Democratic, presidential candidacy on a peace platform, essentially. Everybody's been afraid to talk about peace. But I'm telling you, it is a strong position. It's not a weak position to say this. This is Dwight Eisenhower.
November 4th, vote for peace. Vote for Eisenhower.
A paid film.
Yeah. So November 4th, vote for peace. Vote for Eisenhower. And it's just, and he won. And for 8 years, what was the whole basis of Dwight Eisenhower's presidency for 8 years was essentially two things. Let's keep the economy growing and let's keep world peace. You know, take care of the workers at home, keep the American middle class strong, 90% tax rate on millionaires and billionaires, you know, progressive income tax, strong labor unions, 35% of the American workforce unionized, 70% of Americans with a union-like job, and peace abroad. 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
General Motors got the right idea. Get them little bitty cars out of here. Enron, Chevron, what the heck? I see the USA in my Chevrolet. Gotta be big, gotta be fast. Gotta look good.
Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Got balls. The place where our talking points come from, Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank or the RNC. Yeah, Harry Reid yesterday blowing up the Senate. Here's the official... this is how it happened.
The time has gone by.
This is not.
I demand on behalf of the American people that we understand why these investigations aren't being conducted. And in accordance with Rule 21, I now move that Senate go into closed session.
Mr. President, I second the motion.
The motion has been made to go into closed session, and it has been seconded. The motion having been made and seconded, the Senate will go into closed session. The chair, pursuant to Rule 21, now directs the sergeant-at-arms to clear all galleries, close all doors of the Senate chamber, and exclude from the chamber and its immediate corridors all employees and officials of the Senate who, under the rule, are not eligible to attend the closed session and who are not sworn to secrecy. The question is non-debatable.
Amazing. Rule 21, blow up the Senate. Good on you, Harry. Good on you, Harry. It's what a marvelous thing. Harry Reid blows up the Senate. He says it's a slap. And why? Now, I am not gloating because I'm some partisan Democrat here. In fact, I'm not even a Democrat, although I encourage people to participate in the Democratic Party. Because we have a two-party system, and I think we need to take back the Democratic Party. But I really consider myself to be a political independent, and particularly given the job that I have and the work that I do, I think it's important that I be able to criticize Democrats as well as anybody else. But the fact of the matter is that the Democrats have been sitting on the sideline, sitting this thing out, and the Bush administration has been completely controlling the agenda, And now the Democrats are saying, enough. We had another what, four guys die today, I believe it was, in Iraq. And it's just, the war is continuing. I mean, I was hearing the right-wing spin guys yesterday on CNN and on MSNBC, and they're all like, this is, you know, old investigation, and why do people want to move on and bloody. I'm sorry, there's a war going on. There are people dying. Well, there's really not a war going on. There's an occupation going on. And people are dying. And Harry Reid is speaking out.
It's all part of a plan. They obstruct. They take orders from the White House. They do nothing without getting orders from the White House. The separation of powers doctrine is something that does not exist in this town with the Republican-controlled House, Senate, and, of course, the president.
Yeah. And Harry Reid also on the Iraq war vote comes out and says this.
We had all the information. If the administration had all the information that they have now, back then, they wouldn't even have brought it to the Congress for a vote. But they didn't. We only had the information we had. And as I stated on the floor prior to our going into closed session, we know that there were no WMDs now in Iraq. We didn't know it at the time. We know now that we didn't know at the time that there was no al-Qaeda connection. We know now we didn't know then there was no 9/11 connection. We know now that they had no plan for winning the peace. We didn't know that at the time.
And this is serious stuff. Why did we not know that at the time? Why? I mean, you had Hans Blix out there running around saying, you know, hey, it sure looks to me like there's no weapons of mass destruction here. You had Mohammed al-Baradei saying there's no weapons of mass destruction. You had Article 7 or 9, I forget which, of Resolution 1440. Was it 1440 or 1441? I don't have it right in front of me, but certainly recall this quite clearly. The United Nations resolution that authorized the use of force in Iraq, and it had very specific conditions. It said the only conditions under which force could be used in Iraq, in other words, the only thing that would allow any member of the United Nations, including the United States, by the way, to actually initiate hostilities, to use force against Iraq, was if two conditions were met. Number one, that one of the inspecting agencies, either the IAEA, Mohammed al-Baradei looking for nuclear weapons, or Hans Blix, the Inspector General's office, Hans Blix out there, that they come back and they say to the UN Security Council and the UN in general, we submit a report indicating that there's evidence either the A, that there's weapons, or B, that they're trying to hide something. In that case, then you can initiate force. And two, that there has to be another vote to initiate that force. And the United States attacked Iraq without another vote illegally. We had to go back to the United Nations after the fact and get them after the fact to say, oh, it was okay what you did, because what we did was illegal. And now it's coming out, this whole Scooter Libby thing. I mean, this is the basis of the Scooter Libby thing. What's coming out is that the Bush administration lied us into this war, and they did it for a very specific reason, a very, very specific reason which Cindy Sheehan laid out for us in her testimony before John Conyers. And I'll share with you right after this next break. In my opinion, this is the reason. I mean, there's some folks who think that, you know, the reason that we went there was Cheney's...
Iraq sits on top of 10% of world oil reserves. A very significant reserve, second only to Saudi Arabia.
Well, you know, that sounds good. Frankly, I don't think that's the main reason we went. And I'll tell you why after this. 27 minutes past the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. The Tom Hartman radio program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS. Our question this hour, have we been operating off national victimhood and fear for years? Specifically five. By the way, in our second hour, we're going to ask the question, are Democrats done being scared of the fight, ready to stand up for the people? Sure looks like maybe they're ready for a fight. Also, we're going to be talking with Steve Stallone, the president of the International Labor Communications Association, about this full press assault on labor, including ballot Prop 75 in California. In the third hour of our program, is Bush using the fear of the bird flu to continue the dismantling of American traditions of America, American democracy, of traditions of civil liberties and human rights and privacy and posse comitatus, the law that says that you can't have the army stick their guns in the face of U.S. civilians on the grounds of the soil of the United States? Has he found something else to scare us with? And we're going to talk to Jeff Ziegler in our third hour, president of the Continental Group and government relations director of Operation White Coat, physicians group formed to reform health care. So a lot of stuff we're going to bounce around here today. We should have Tigger music here for the show. Back to the study on terror, this mortality salience. I find this fascinating. If you tell people, if you have people imagine that they're going to die and then ask them who they would vote for, Kerry or Bush, they actually did this during the election. They might have been willing to vote for Kerry before that. And we're not talking, tell them to imagine their death in the context of 9/11 or anything else. You know, like just imagine that they're going to die of a heart attack or of old age. Just think about their own death. Who are they going to vote for? It starts swinging towards Bush, towards an authoritarian figure. 1-866-440-8255. 866-866-4400. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. Matt in Castleton, Vermont on the line. Hey, Matt, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to mention the unfair comparison of Bush to Hitler, and I have 3 points I'll tell you, and I think you'll agree with me when I'm done, okay?
Sure.
The first one, Bush doesn't have a mustache. Hitler had that cool mustache, okay? The second one, Hitler was elected by his people. And the third, Hitler, unlike Bush, was able to fulfill his military service.
And, in fact, earned the Iron Cross. Your second one is wrong, though. Hitler was not elected by his people initially. He was appointed by Hindenburg. His party
okay.
held a minority in the parliament, and when the Reichstag gebouw caught on fire, he was at dinner that night with von Papen and Hindenburg, trying to talk Hindenburg into making him the Reichschancellor.
I stand corrected. It is a fair comparison.
Okay.
I'll tell you what. Muhammad Ali had it wrong. You are the greatest.
Okay. Thanks a lot,
Thank
Matt.
You. Bye.
You're welcome. Anyhow, so what happened when the Reichstag caught on fire, Hitler leaves this dinner. He runs over to the parliament building. The radio station, they didn't have TV then, the radio stations are there. He calls a press conference, and he stands in front of the microphones, and he says, "This is a sign from God." He's talking about the fire of the burning of the Reichstag, and he declares a war on terrorism and the evil philosophy and religion that was at its core, meaning specifically communism and Judaism in Hitler's worldview. And thus, you know, we got what we got. And, you know, what a tragedy it is. I mean, it's just as Milton Mayer, who was a reporter in Chicago, who after World War II went over to Germany to talk to average Germans and say, how could you have done this? How could you have, you know, didn't you see the trains going by? Didn't you hear the stories? There were over 130 concentration camps inside Germany. Now, granted, they were all prison camps. There were a few like Dachau that had such intensive work facilities, or where they were having cholera epidemics. You know, people were dying. Actually, in Dachau, there were some people executed by firing squad. But by and large, they were work camps. They put the death machine camps outside Germany so that after the war, when Hitler had won, he could say, "Oh, look at what those nasty, nasty, nasty Poles did in Treblinka, and look at what those nasty Dutch did in Belsen, and on and on." I mean, it's in Auschwitz, Poland. And, you know, he was going to blame it on others. Does that sound familiar? Anyhow, Milton Mayer went over and interviewed Germans who survived Hitler's era. Many of them German Christians, some of them German Jews. And he wrote a book called They Thought They Were Free. Still in print, Chicago University Press. In fact, it's going to be our BuzzFlash Book of the Month next month. And this one guy, he was interviewing him, and the guy says to Milton Mayer, Mayer says, you know, how could you have done this? How could, you know, you were just an average guy. You know, how did this happen? And the guy said, what happened here was the gradual habituation of the people, little by little, to being governed by surprise, to receiving decisions deliberated in secret, to believing that the situation was so complicated that the government had to act on information which the people could not understand, or so dangerous that if the people could understand it, it couldn't be released because of national security. Another friend, another person that he interviewed, told him, and I quote, "This separation of government from people, this widening of the gap, took place so gradually and so insensibly, each step disguised, perhaps not even intentionally, as a temporary emergency measure, or associated with true patriotic allegiance, or with real social purposes. And all the crises and reforms, real reforms too, so occupied the people that they did not see the slow motion underneath, the whole process of government growing remoter and remoter." He said to Mayer, he said, "To live in this process is absolutely not to be able to notice it. Please try to believe me, unless one has a much greater degree of political awareness, acuity than most of us ever had occasion to develop. Each step was so small, so inconsequential, so well explained or on occasion regretted, that unless one were detached from the whole process from the beginning, unless one understood what the whole thing was in principle, what all these little measures that no patriotic German could resent must one day lead to, One no more saw it developing from day to day than a farmer in his field sees the corn growing, until one day it is over his head. Another conversation. Another German. This guy, a Christian, who taught in a university. He's talking to Milton Mayer. He's being interviewed after World War II. He worked all the way through the war. And he said, Pastor Niemöller spoke for the thousands and thousands of men like me when he spoke too modestly of himself and said that when the Nazis attacked the communists, he was a little uneasy. After all, he wasn't a communist, and so he did nothing. And then they attacked the socialists, and he was a little uneasier. But still, he wasn't a socialist, and he did nothing. And then the schools, the press, the Jews, and so on. And he was always uneasier, but still he did nothing. And then they attacked the church, and he was a churchman, and he did something, but it was too late. Yes, I said. This is Mayer interviewing him. You see, my colleague went on, one doesn't see exactly where or how to move. Believe me, this is true. Each act, each occasion is worse than the last, but only a little worse. You wait for the next and the next. You wait for the one great shocking occasion, thinking that others, when such a shock comes, will join with you in resisting somehow. You don't want to act or even talk alone. You don't want to go out of your way to make trouble. Why not? Well, you're not in the habit of doing it. And it's not just fear of standing alone that restrains you. It is also genuine uncertainty. Uncertainty is a very important factor, and instead of decreasing as time goes on, it actually grows. Outside in the streets, in the general community, everyone is happy. One hears no protest, certainly sees none. You know, in France or Italy, there were slogans against the government painted on walls and fences. In Germany, maybe outside the great cities, but pretty much not even this. Here in the university community, in your own community, you speak privately to your colleagues, some of whom certainly feel as you do, but what do they say? They say, oh, it's not so bad. You're seeing things. You're an alarmist. And you are an alarmist. You're saying, again, I'm quoting from this interview with an academic, a Christian academic who worked as a college professor all through the Nazi years in Germany. He says, and you are alarmist. You are saying that this must lead to that, and you can't prove it. These are the beginnings, yes, but how do you know for sure when you don't know the end? You don't even know how to surmise the end. On the one hand, your enemies, the law, the regime, the party, they intimidate you. On the other hand, your colleagues poo-poo you as pessimistic or even neurotic. But the one great shocking occasion, when tens or hundreds of thousands will join you, never comes. That's the difficulty. If the last and worst act of the whole regime had come immediately after the first and the smallest, thousands, yes, millions of Germans would have been sufficiently shocked if, let us say, the gassing of the Jews in 43 came immediately after the German firm stickers in the windows of the non-Jewish shops in 1933. But, of course, that wasn't the way it happened. In between come all the hundreds of little steps, some of them imperceptible, each of them preparing you not to be shocked by the next. C is not so much worse than B. And if you did not take a stand at B, why should you at C? And so on to D. And one day your principles, if you were ever sensible of them, all rush in upon you. The burden of self-deception has grown too heavy. And some minor incidents, in my case, my little boy, hardly more than a baby, saying, Jew swine, to a man on the street, collapses it all at once. And you see that everything has changed. And changed completely under your nose. The world you live in, your nation, your people, it's not the world you were in at all. The forms are all there. They're all untouched, all reassuring. The houses, the shops, the jobs, the mealtimes, the visits, the concerts, the cinema, the holidays. But the spirit, which you never noticed because you made the lifelong mistake of identifying it with the forms, is changed. Now you live in a world of hate and fear. And the people who hate and fear do not even know it themselves. When everyone is transformed, no one is transformed. Now you live in a system with rules without even, not even responsible to God. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
It's coming through a hole in the air from those Nazis in Tiananmen Square. It's coming from a field that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there.
Well, let's hope Leonard's right and it's coming.
The war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA.
Indeed. Now, here's why this is an imperfect comparison. Hitler was a mass murderer. He was a maniacal dictator and a mass murderer. George W. Bush, in my opinion, is not. I don't think he's mentally sound, and I do believe that he has the blood of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of people unnecessarily on his hands. But I can't put him in a league with Hitler. But what we are seeing, and we are seeing, I think, very clearly, is this incrementalism. This creeping loss of liberty. Can you imagine if George W. Bush in the debates with Al Gore had said if he was made president, he was going to build 5 concentration camps and put people in them who had never even been accused of a crime for years, perhaps for the rest of their lives, that he would authorize interrogations that would lead to the death of at least, I mean, we know of over 30 people who died as a consequence of being tortured. And hundreds who have vanished. That he would thumb his nose at the Geneva Conventions. That he would prevent the American Red Cross from visiting his prison facilities. That he would take an American citizen and put him in prison for 3 years and refuse to allow him to talk to his lawyer and refuse to allow the American citizen to even have a charge brought against him, much less make bail or have a trial. If he had said that was what he intended to do in 2000 in that debate with Al Gore, do you think anybody would have voted for him? Even if November 11, 2001, if he had said, hey, this is what we're going to have to do. Frankly, I doubt most of Americans would have gone along with it. Instead, they just do this stuff, and it's every little step, incremental step, step by step by step by step. Dangerous stuff. This is dangerous stuff. It doesn't mean necessarily, it doesn't even mean probably that we're going down the road to death camps in America or something like that. But it does mean that we are heading down the road to the loss of liberty in the United States in a tragic way. And that's, you know, the big difference between the United States and Germany was that the Germans in the 1930s had never had more than about 15 years of democracy. And yeah, they had kings for 1,000 years, kaisers. And they wanted another king, and they got it in Hitler. Here in the United States, we've had democracy in various forms, for better or for worse. I mean, stronger and weaker, but we have had democracy for over 230 years. It's burned into our DNA now. And that's what gives me tremendous hope. That's why I don't think we're going to continue down this road. That's why when the Howard Beale moment occurs to Harry Reid, I say, good on you, Harry. You're standing up for the average American. And that's why when Cindy Sheehan speaks out, I told you I would share this with you, about why Bush took us to war, I think it's so important that Americans hear that and know that.
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalists and longtime Bush family friend Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, "One of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency," end quote. It looks like George Bush was ready to lead this country into an avoidable war even before he became president.
That was 99.
From the expose of the Downing Street memo and the conversations with George Bush from 1999, it seems like the invasion of Iraq and the deaths of so many innocent people were preordained. It appears that my boy Casey was given a death sentence even before he joined the Army in May of 2000.
Indeed. Cindy Sheehan speaking to this issue. So here we have fear as a motivating power. And then on top of that, this series of amazing coincidences. Now we have this study that establishes that if you can make people fearful, they are more likely to vote for George W. Bush than for John Kerry. And then May 18th, 2002, details of the president's daily briefing, August 6, 2001, are revealed, including its title, Bin Laden Determined to Strike in the U.S. 2 days later, FBI Director Robert Mueller declares another terrorist attack is inevitable. The following day, the Department of Homeland Security raises warnings, issues warnings of attacks on railroads and New York City landmarks. Everybody's terrified. June 6, 2002, Colleen Rowley comes out and says, hey, well, I tried to tell you guys about Moussaoui. 4 days later, John Ashcroft reveals that Jose Padilla is under arrest. He's been under arrest for over a month, but that, you know, convenient time. February 5th, 2003, Secretary of State Colin Powell tells the UN Security Council about Iraq's concealed weapons. 2 days later, amidst anti-war demonstrations around the planet, Homeland Security Secretary Tom Ridge cites credible threats by al-Qaeda and raises the terror alert level to orange. July 24, 2003, Congressional report on 9/11 concludes Iraq had no link to al-Qaeda. 5 days later, amid headlines about U.S. troops abusing Iraqi prisoners, the Department of Homeland Security issues warnings of further terrorist attempts to use airplanes for suicide attacks. And then we go back, and the list goes on. This is part of, you know, these 13 coincidences that Keith Olbermann compiled. And then we go back and hear from Tom Ridge when he left his job as Director of Homeland Security. And Tom Ridge saying over and over and over again, he said it on The Daily Show, he said it on Good Morning America. I mean, pretty much anybody who would listen to him said, hey, it wasn't my idea to raise those terror alerts. That came out of the White House. In fact, I was opposed to most of them. Are we being manipulated with fear, my friends? And are the Democrats starting to say, hey, enough is enough? We want to know the truth. We want to know to what extent were we lied to make us fearful. And how did you exploit that? How did you use that political capital that you thought you could get from that? 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, to the real free speech zone. No barbed wire. You won't be dragged off if you've got a no blood for oil bumper sticker on your car. You don't need a press pass or a visitor pass, I want to attend the event pass from the RNC. It's the real free speech on the Tom Hartman radio program, broadcasting live on stations from coast to coast on Sirius Satellite Radio, RadioPower.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, AirAmericaRadio.com, and CRN Digital as well. Welcome back to our program. Steve Stallone is with us. He's the president of the International Labor Communications Association, ILCAOnline.org, the main website. But you also have a website, BetterCA, as in BetterCalifornia.org?
Yes, Tom.
That's
the website for the campaign on the initiatives that are on the California ballot.
Okay, so betterca.org. You'd like folks to check it out. Before we get to that, Steve, I do want to talk about Prop 75 and what it's up to. But just yesterday, Bernie Sanders came out and pointed out, you know, something very important about Sam Alito. You know, this guy that Bush has put up as a distraction from Treasongate, basically. The Republicans had begged him not to put forward a Supreme Court nominee until after the holidays because they don't want to have, you know, special sessions and things, but he did it anyway. And it turns out in 1996, Alito was the sole dissenter in a case concerning a female hotel employee who complained of sexual harassment. In his ruling, Alito sought to raise the bar, I'm quoting from Bernie Sanders, for the requirement of filing a sex discrimination claim. During a 2000 suit in Pennsylvania concerning a state employee who was fired for taking unpaid sick leave, Alito told Congress, said that Congress went too far by passing the Family and Medical Leave Act and the state was not required to abide by it. This guy is anti-labor.
Apparently, and that's the kind of research into his background that needs to be done.
That's positively scary. Well, speaking of anti-labor, I think we probably should have known right from the get-go. And by the way, let me preface this by saying we're going to talk about California here for a few minutes, but every state in the union, this is not a California show. I mean, we're on several stations in California, certainly, but everybody all across the United States should be paying attention to this, because this is coming to a town near you, friends. When Arnold Schwarzenegger first came in as governor and he said he was not going to take any money from special interest groups, and then he starts taking all his campaign cash from big corporations, and somebody says, hey, what do you mean, no special interest groups? And he says, oh, you know, trade associations, corporate groups, that's not special interest groups. Special interest groups are unions. And, we should have said, what?
It is amazing. It is amazing that only the organizations that represent working people are special interests.
Yeah, so what is Prop 75, one of his little going-to-get-you things?
Well, Prop 75, is they call it paycheck protection, but the unions call it paycheck deception. Basically, it requires each individual member of a union to fill out a form allowing the union to use part of their dues for political action. The paperwork and bureaucracy involved would use up most of the money that one would raise anyway. So it basically, what it does is it makes the unions incapable of being able to be part of the political process.
Now, let me get this straight. If I'm, you know, for example, a Mormon, I'm not, but Mormons are very, very fastidious about tithing. Many Catholics are very fastidious about tithing. In fact, when we lived in Germany, you had the option of having 10% of your paycheck, or any percent you wanted to specify, but 10 was the default, automatically given to a church nearby you. And you know, it was just, it's like the government actually offers this as a service to do your tithing. Okay, so if I'm a member of a church and to which I tithe, or if I'm a member of you know, the Moose or the Elks or whatever, and I'm paying them dues, I'm paying them regular dues, and they want to make a political statement, they don't have to come to me and get my permission. Why should the union that I'm a member of have to come to me and get permission? If I don't like the political positions my union is taking, I can work within my union, it is a democratic organization, to overthrow the management and hire somebody else, you know, elect somebody else to be the new union president.
Yeah, you can do that, and you can also simply opt out of having your money being used for political purposes. There, the U.S. Supreme Court has already ruled and set up a procedure whereby union members can opt out of having their share of their dues money go to political activity, and that's, you know, what's unnecessary about this. And as you're saying, it's also unfair that only these unions are being singled out for this. It's not as if corporations have to have their stockholders sign specific forms allowing them to make donations to political campaigns. If you wanted real electoral reform, these rules should be across the board. I mean, already corporations' business is outspending labor, depending upon whose statistics you use, 10 to 1 or 24 to 1. But it's, you know, whatever numbers you want to play with, it still shows that they're being outspent tremendously, and now they're being singled out to have even that small amount taken away.
Well, and in fact, when business engages in these PR campaigns like Walmart is doing right now, they can actually deduct it from their taxes.
Exactly.
I mean, it's just, it's mind-boggling. Now, they're calling this paycheck protection. And yet, I don't get my. I'm a member of a union. Actually, I'm a member of two unions. I'm a member of the Writers Union, and I'm a member of AFTRA, the American Federation of Television and Radio Actors, or whatever, performers, or whatever it's called. And you know, my union dues, or my AFTRA dues anyway, are taken out of my paycheck here for the morning show that I do on KPOJ, AM 620 KPOJ in Portland, Clear Channel Station. And but not the national show, that's a whole different thing. But in any case, as you know, that's taken out of my paycheck. But my paycheck doesn't come from AFTRA. My paycheck comes from, in this case, Clear Channel. And so, you know, my employer, or the local radio station, KPOJ, actually. And so if we were going to actually have paycheck protection, that means that I have a say in how my paycheck money is used. Shouldn't I have the right to say how my employer is using the money that's ultimately going to be, or if it's not there, not be my paycheck?
It's an interesting way of looking at it.
I mean, really, if we're going to talk about paycheck protection, where does the paycheck come from? It comes from the employer. So the employees should be able to say, hey, listen, United Airlines, if you're going to go out and spend millions of dollars on lobbying and whining and dining Tom Delay, and that means you're going to bankrupt our pension fund and we're not going to have any money left over, we'd like to have some say in how you spend that money.
Yeah, and it's also hard to believe the actual backers of this, quote, paycheck protection are mostly large corporations, corporations like Walmart and AmeriQuest and even the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the California Chamber of Commerce. I mean, these are the people who are the strongest people coming out against a raise in the minimum wage, but somehow they're concerned about workers' paychecks and protecting them from big, bad union dues.
Well, you know, I think it's amazing. I think that this is a meme, a phrase, a thought virus that perhaps we could flip around and throw back at them if there was some elegant, you know, verbal jujitsu to do. Because the bottom line here is that my paycheck and everybody's paycheck, you know, who works for a corporation, their paycheck originates with that corporation, not with the union. And so if the point of paycheck protection laws is to make sure that the money that is in that ends up in your paycheck is not being endangered by frivolous involvement in politics, then I, as an employee of the company for which I work, should be able to say, you know, have some say in whether or not that company is involved in politics.
Certainly.
Yeah. So now, Steve, how do we craft this message and get it out there? We're talking, by the way, with Steve Stallone. He's the president of the International Labor Communications Association, ILCAonline.org, and they've got a new campaign here against Proposition 75 in California, Better CA, as in California, BetterCA.org, the website.
I'm sorry, your question was, Tom?
Yeah, well, I'm just Steve. What we only have a minute left here. What would you like people to do? How can people get active to support your efforts against Prop 75? Because, like I said, if it passes in California, it's coming to a town near you next.
Well, the campaign continues, and although things are going well, the latest field poll that came out yesterday shows that movement is going in our direction, and we are now the no vote is now 50% to 40% supporting Prop 75, but I suggest that people, particularly if they can go to that website, betterca.com, can find information about it, find a way to contribute to the campaign, and if they're in California, very important, because even though the numbers are going well in our direction right now, it's a special off-year election. Predictions are for a low voter turnout. Everything is going to depend on the turnout.
Right. So people should just check out betterca.org and see how they can participate.
Yeah.
Bottom line, great. Steve Stallone, the president of the International Labor Communications Association. Steve, as always, great having you on the program. I congratulate you on the marvelous work you're doing protecting the rights of workers across America. It is vital stuff.
Thank you, Tom.
You're welcome. ILCAonline.org and BetterCA.org. Check it out. It's 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
He took all the trees and put them in a tree museum. And he charged the people a dollar and a half to see them.
Yes, the dream of the Bush administration. You know, back 15, 20 years ago, I think Carly Simon first wrote that. So when that first song came, or the song first came out, we all thought, oh, yeah. Chuckle, chuckle, chuckle. Tee-hee, roar, roar. And then came the No Tree Left Behind initiative. Anyhow, Ellen Ratner is with us with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen, welcome to the program.
Well, you actually have Greg Gorman with you first.
Oh, I have.
And I are going to tag team today, if you don't
mind. Greg Gorman. Hey, Greg, great to have you on.
Hey, Tom, always good to be with you. I was at the court this morning. And next,
as in the Supreme Court?
Yes, at the Supreme Court. And I wanted to bring your attention to two interesting cases that the court is going to hear next week as well, which I think you'll like. One of the cases this morning has to do with whether or not, if you do not pay your student loans in a court called Lockhart versus United States, if a person does not pay his student loans, can the government come in and offset your loan payment by reducing your Social Security benefits? And there is a 10-year limitation under something called the Debt Collection Act that if you don't pay your student loans, the government really can't do anything. However, in this case, what the court will hear is if that happens, can the government go in and when you take or when you start taking all your Social Security benefits, can they offset that with what you owe on your student loan? So this is something that we'll watch over the next few weeks.
Yeah, on the one hand, you know, I think everybody's in favor of individual responsibility. On the other hand, you know, a student loan when somebody's 20 and Social Security when somebody's 65, or if somebody's 30 and they fall and break their neck and are paralyzed from the neck down and they have to go on Social Security, and now they can't pay their student loan, they can't work, and their Social Security benefits are the only thing that are keeping them alive, as is the case with a good friend of mine, Michael Hutchison, who's a fellow author. I mean, this is exactly what happened to him, and he's living on Social Security now. And what if Michael had student loans that he hadn't paid yet? He'd be toast.
Well, that's exactly right. If the government went in with your friend and stopped his Social Security benefits or reduced them somehow in order to offset the cost of his unpaid student loan, what would happen to him? And, of course, you could probably
die. I mean, you know, he would be homeless and foodless is the bottom line. I mean, Michael is back to writing. He's the author. He wrote a book called Megabrain years ago, ironically, and a number of books, The Anatomy of Sex and Power and others. And he's writing a book right now, but he's only doing it because finally he was able to get software that could convert his speech into computer stuff. And it took him 2 years through the Social Security Administration and with a little help from his friends to just get, you know, just buy a PC and make the thing work right. Because he can't use his hands and he can't type.
You know, it's very interesting because that's what people were talking about this morning, in that, look, this is not just always about if you go to college and you take out loans when you're 22 and then you wait 40 years until you start to get your benefits. I mean, there are always extenuating circumstances, which is, of course, why the court heard this case.
Right. One-third of all people getting Social Security benefits are not retirees.
Absolutely. Exactly.
This is incredible. Okay, so, I mean, as I said, we're all in favor of personal responsibility, and there's a reason why it's called the social safety net. It's to catch people who fall through the cracks.
And
of course, the conservatives don't believe that there should be such a thing. They call that socialism, and they think that it encourages people to look for cracks to jump through. And maybe 1 out of 1,000 it does, but, hey, I'm willing to have 1 out of 1,000 people game the system if it means that for the other 999 of us, we have a system.
Well, that's exactly what the court will look at and heard this morning, and I'll make sure and get back to you and your friend
as soon as there is
a decision sometime in the next few months.
Great. Thank you, Greg.
You're welcome. And I've got Ellen Radner here beside me. She's going to give you a daily about Congress.
Great. Thanks.
Most interesting thing, Tom, is that the president is looking for $2 billion to boost Northrop Grumman shipyards in the Gulf. Now, it is true there's a lot of jobs. But what they're planning on doing in the Gulf of Mexico, you're talking about. That's right. To get this shipbuilding facility up after Katrina, is they are planning on actually taking money away from FEMA that was going to go to the people who needed it.
Oh, wait a minute. To rebuild Northrop Grumman's shipbuilding facility, they're going to say that you can't rebuild your house?
Well, what they're planning on doing is they essentially said the way they're going to try and pay for this is to go directly, without passing go, to the FEMA money that was there, and they want to redirect $17.1 billion in fund intended for FEMA to help federal agencies from the storm. And, of course, the federal agencies are going to be things that are going to help going for things such as building Northrop Grumman's area.
You know, these guys in the last 4 years have cut taxes on billionaires and multimillionaires by over $1 trillion, over $1,000 billion. They can't take $2 billion of those tax cuts and say, we're going to roll back the tax cuts a little bit?
Is that unbelievable?
Yeah, well, apparently it's unmentionable. Well, welcome to the wonderful world of Republican, so-called conservative politics. I mean, even Dwight Eisenhower wouldn't have gone along with this.
I thought you'd be interested.
Just amazing. By the way, last night, Ellen, I saw Goodnight and Goodbye. Have you seen the movie?
I saw it. I thought it was great. I'm going to go see it again.
It's absolutely brilliant. It's every American needs to see that movie.
I agree with you 100%. I saw it on Saturday.
Yeah, it's great. Good talking to you, Alan. Thanks so much for the great work you and Greg and everybody else at TalkRadioNews.com are doing.
You're welcome.
Okay, we'll talk to you soon. It's Ellen Ratner, our bureau chief in Washington, D.C. It's 27 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman radio program. You are right smack dab in the middle of the vast, radical, middle conspiracy. Take no imitations, my friends.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
I'm George W. Bush, and I approve this song.
Uh-oh.
I could kill a couple minutes just talking to lieutenants about Saddam Hussein. I could grasp what they were saying and the dangerous game we're playing if I only had a brain.
If only.
With my thoughts unconstipated, I'd be intellectualated and thinking without pain. Each executive decision would be based on more than wishing if I only had a brain.
And welcome back, my friends. 35 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And, you know, in a way, that's kind of the problem, is that it's easy to cartoon or lampoon George W. Bush when, in fact, what's happening are real. We're having real problems in this country and in this world. And it's not, they're not happening because George W. Bush is an idiot. I realize it may be impolitic to say it, but I think that this guy is very smart. He has a different kind of intelligence, perhaps, than I do. I suspect, you know, if you've ever met somebody in your life who was like just an absolute natural salesman, the old backslapping good old boy, there's a particular unique type of intelligence there. And they may not be able to cite facts from history. They can't remember what they learned in school. They don't read the newspaper and keep, you know, it's not a front brain kind of intellect. It's kind of a back brain kind of intellect. Daniel Goleman wrote this book called Emotional Intelligence and really kicked open this idea. I'm forgetting Howard's last name, but anyhow, another guy wrote a book about the seven types of intelligence. And, you know, I think that we underestimate George W. Bush at our own peril, frankly. Today, Scotty McClellan, speaking as we were about Howard Gardner, excuse me, was the guy who wrote The Seven Intelligences. Thank you, Louise. Earlier in the last hour, we were talking about the parallels between the rise of fascism in Germany and the loss of liberty in Germany, let's say, the loss of individual liberties and civil rights, and the loss of individual liberties and civil rights in the United States. And you know, Germany's the one that everybody's familiar with, but the same thing has happened over and over. It happened in Italy, in Italy under Mussolini. It happened in Spain under Franco. It happened in Argentina under Pinochet. It happened in Chile. On and on the list goes. It's like, you know, there's no shortage of them. And is it now happening here in the United States? Scotty McClellan saying, as earlier in the year, he says, as we carry out the war on terrorism and seek to prevent attacks from happening, we must adhere to those laws and we must adhere to these treaty obligations and we must adhere to our values. Well, today the Washington Post has a shocking report. It was on the front page of the Oregonian, our paper here in Portland, Oregon. Host countries have signed the UN Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, and Degrading Treatment or Punishment, as has the United States. Yet, according from the Washington Post, yet CIA interrogators in overseas sites are permitted to use the CIA's approved enhanced interrogation techniques, some of which are prohibited by the UN Convention and by U.S. military law. You get that? It's against the law what they're doing. They may include tactics such as waterboarding, in which a prisoner is made to believe he or she is drowning. They go on to note that the prisons were approved by, quote, a small circle of White House and Justice Department lawyers and officials, according to several former and current U.S. government and intelligence officials, end quote. Now, this is not some, you know, as Limbaugh would portray progressives, liberals, the ACLU, whatever, people who are concerned about human rights, this is not some guy saying, oh, those poor terrorists, treat them nicely. I mean, that's the caricature with which the Reich has always portrayed people who are interested in representing human rights. But the reality is that, number one, if you want to get good intelligence out of somebody who is a captive of yours, you're not going to get it by pulling their fingernails out. You're going to get the best intelligence by inducing the Stockholm Syndrome, by making them identify with you, by breaking the hold that their cult has on them and giving them your cult, your belief system. This goes from Ted Patrick deprogramming cult members to interrogations done that go all the way back in history. The way you get the best information is by turning people, not terrorizing people. When you terrorize people, the information you get is generally unreliable. People will tell you anything to stop the pain. And more often than not, it's not the truth. And if they're inclined to tell you the truth under pain, all the evidence, all the research, I mean, all of it indicates that they would be even more inclined to tell you the truth under agreement. If you could induce that false Stockholm syndrome. And this is why John McCain, who was a victim of torture, who spent 5 years in a prisoner of war camp, who was an officer in the United States military during time of war, who actually served his country, and who was mercilessly smeared by Karl Rove when they did push polls in the 2000 election in South Carolina and called people up and said, if you knew that John McCain's black baby was actually an out-of-wedlock child from a black woman, would you still vote for him? And if you knew that John McCain's wife was taking a psychiatric medication for and was promiscuous, would you still vote for... John McCain, the victim of Karl Rove's smears, you know, not apropos to this, obviously, but useful to remind us. John McCain is saying, hey, let's have a rider attached to the defense appropriation bill that says that if we're going to use money for defense, we're going to use it in compliance simply with U.S. military law, with existing military. He doesn't want to create any new laws, simply in compliance with existing military laws. Just amazing. Absolutely amazing. And you know, where is it going? Well, we'll see. Bush has said that he's going to veto this. He's going to veto this. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM, and Jeff in Sacramento on the line. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. Jeff, what's up?
Well, I just want to comment on the interview you had with that guy regarding Proposition 75.
Right.
You know, there are several things that he has indicated or said that I believe is incorrect. Number one, the measure only applies to public employee unions, not private ones. And, you know, these unions...
You ever heard the phrase, the camel's nose under the edge of the tent, Jeff?
Pardon me?
Have you ever heard the old phrase, it's a Middle Eastern phrase, the camel's nose is under the edge of the tent?
No, I haven't.
Okay, well, the bottom line is you start with one, and then it's no big deal to go to the next one. Yeah, we will outlaw it for the public employee unions, and then worked well for them. Let's make it all unions.
No, but
you know the direction this is going.
No, but see, the private unions have long since lost their power in California because of competition. They slowly have deteriorated. The public unions are getting stronger.
The private unions have not lost their power in California as a result of competition, Jeff. I'm sorry. The private unions in California have lost their power as a consequence of union-busting techniques being used by large employers in California,
but
being sanctioned by the government and by the Department of Labor under a series of hostile administrations, starting with Ronald Reagan when he declared war on the average working person in the United States in 1981 by going after PATCO.
But the grocery union... even like the post office, when they have competition, they can't pay their employee more, and so there has to be a little compromise. Okay,
because we've got this race to the bottom going on right now because of our insane trade policies that are the Republicans trying to offshore and outsource all of our jobs.
Okay, but when they can't pay anymore because they can't make anymore, they have to compromise somewhere. And before,
how about Jeff? How about not paying as much in dividends to their stockholders?
That's, I mean, even
that's
they
unacceptable to you.
I mean, they just closed down. I mean,
no, they won't. Come on, you've got corporations that are showing record profits. ExxonMobil just showed the largest profit in the history of the world.
ExxonMobil is one example that you guys like to use a lot. But think of all the other, look at all the grocery stores that have closed down because they can't compete against Walmart.
Right. Yeah, because Walmart uses union-busting tactics. Walmart goes in and terrifies people from unionizing. You get one Walmart that successfully unionizes a meat-cutting operation, and what do? They shut down meat-cutting operations all over the country. You get
but
one Walmart in Canada
prices.
That successfully unionizes, and what do? They shut down the entire store.
Yeah, but they give us low prices.
The percentage.
And we have to choose between supporting low prices or having high wages.
That is absolute nonsense, Jeff. If you want to see the spiral to the bottom, sure. Yeah. Would Americans rather pay 10% more at Walmart and then 30% more on their paychecks, or would they rather have the lower prices at Walmart and have even lower paychecks? We have been on your conservative spiral to the bottom for 15, 25 years now, and what we are seeing is it is destroying the American middle class. It is eating alive the American middle class. It's not a choice between low prices at Walmart and high prices at Walmart. It's a choice between low prices at Walmart and no protection for labor and lousy paychecks, or prices at Walmart that were like they were back when Sam Walton ran Walmart and everything was made in the United States, and having a good union job in the United States and a decent paycheck.
But getting back to the Proposition 75.
Yes, okay.
Let's see. The
so you can see my point.
Okay, for one thing, it is the public employees that are supporting the legislators. They're the ones that are getting the benefit of all these union activities. And
that's how it's supposed to work, Jeff. Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate your call. I'm sorry we're out of time. It's always great to argue with somebody on the other side, though. Anybody else who wants to take me on, give me a call. 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I ain't lived forever, but I've lived enough.
And welcome back.
I've learned to be gentle and I've learned to be tough. I found only two things that last till the end. One is your heroes,
the other's your friends. Welcome back. I am sorry, I can't help it. I started out as a rock and roll teenager and got my first job in radio as a country western DJ, and I love them both. What can I say? 9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-8466. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. And Alice in Eureka, California. Hey, Alice, how are you today?
Morning, Tom.
Good morning. Always great to hear from you and to know that at 91 you're still kicking there, Alice.
I wanted to let everyone know that there is going to be more demonstrations again today.
Yes, the worldcan'twait.org, with no apostrophe in the can't.
The organizers are called the World Can't Wait.
Yep.
I know that here in Humboldt County, we will be meeting in front of our courthouse in Eureka. People can find out what is in their town on the worldcan'twait.com.
.org. Is it .com?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, .com. I stand corrected. Thank you.
We will be taking our portable radios with us to hear you, Tom.
Okay, great. Thank you, Alice.
Yeah. So they're having a big deal.
Okay, well, have a wonderful time there. And thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. 1-866-440-THOM. Fred in New York City. Hey, Fred. Fred?
a World Can't Wait rally in New York City.
Uh-huh.
In Union Square. As near as I can tell, I'm not good with crowds. I think there's about 1,000 or more people there.
Oh, that's great. You're there now?
Yes, and it's just great to see everyone coming out to impeach the Bush administration.
Yeah, this is that's right. It's let's see, it must be 2 hours past. It's coming up on 2 o'clock there, right?
Just about, yeah. They just had James Yee's family speaking a while ago.
Ah, okay. That's great. That's great.
And there's about 20 to 25 Bush supporters across the street.
Okay, and so worldcan'twait.com, the website for more information.
I think it's .org. It's
.org.
They had some kind of server problems. I think you can actually even find them at .net right now.
Oh, okay. So just keep trying until you find it, and you'll figure it out.
I think it's currently at .net. Yeah,
somebody's been tampering
it.
With them. Okay, Fred, thanks a lot. Great to hear from you, and thanks for the update. Things are happening in New York City. Good to know. Very well. Very, very well. Let's see, Rebecca in Edmonds, Washington on the line. Hey, Rebecca, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you. I really appreciate your program so much. I've been telling everybody I know about it and when to tune in and all of that.
Well, bless you, Rebecca. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And our sponsors, the most important thing is to let our sponsors.
After our November 8th election here, I'm going to get your book and read it. What I want to call about is the double standard that just drives me crazy sometimes between the Republicans. Okay, two examples really quickly. District Judge Bob Perkins in Texas was replaced because, you know, it was known that he had contributed to the Democrats, Kerry and so forth. But Judge Roberts, the evidence that he had contributed to the Bush campaigns didn't matter, and yet he's sitting as Supreme Court Justice.
Right. That's not a double standard. That's called lowball politics. I mean, that's...
Okay, call it lowball politics. I don't care. But here's another example. Senator Frist yesterday just, you know, crazily complaining about Senator Reid's and the Democrats breaking Senate traditions.
Yeah, he threw a hissy fit.
What about the traditions of honoring the other party in committees and getting bills out and so forth? They just squash tradition all the time.
Yeah, and it's not tradition. I mean, the last time was 25 years ago, granted, but still, it's Rule 21 is there for a reason, and so it was used for a reason.
Well, but it's just so blatant. I don't know if a lot of people are picking up on the double standard or the, you know, whatever. What did you call it?
Yeah, I don't remember now.
Anyway, but I have one other topic I'd like to mention before I hang up, and that
very
is...
Very quickly, please.
Okay, really quickly. I wish that everybody would call, instead of Treasongate, I wish they'd say Traitorgate, because it's kind of like Watergate. And if people say it enough, people will start to make the association between the corruption, the crime, and all of that.
Traitorgate.
So,
okay.
Traitorgate. And
I'll have to get to it, but I'm not sure if I can. Rebecca, thank you for the call. I've got to move along real quickly. Eileen in Westboro, Pennsylvania. Hey, Eileen.
It's Waynesboro, Tom.
Waynesboro. I'm sorry. We only have a half a minute left or so, Eileen. I'm sorry.
You were talking about Bush's intellect a while ago, and I really don't think it's intelligence. I think he's shrewd. I think there's a difference between intelligence and shrewdness, and I think what he is shrewd, and a lot of people go far on being shrewd. But
that was my point, that it's a different type of intelligence. It's not the IQ kind of intelligence, but
exactly.
There is a brilliance there. You don't get to become president of the United States without it, regardless of how well connected you are.
He is shrewd, and that kind of fits him, I think.
And he's able to make people very loyal, and he's able to make people very afraid who are near him. And you know, not unlike mafia bosses, for example, who I think have the very same kind of shrewdness.
Well, yes, when you have the money and power that his family has, I mean, people will be afraid.
And not just that. I mean, he exercises that power in ways that appropriately cause fear. People who have crossed him end up in the ditch. Their lives are gone. Their careers are destroyed. Their wives are outed. I mean, you cross George Bush at your peril.
Yes.
If you run in circles where he can cause damage to you.
And you can see it in his eyes.
Yeah, I don't disagree. Eileen, thanks a lot for the call. It's nice to hear from you. And thank you for your kind comments. So where do we go from here? Where we go from here, my friends, is we are 1 year out now. It's November. We are 1 year out from an election. And this is an election where it is actually possible that the Democrats could take back the House and the Senate. And at least one or the other, possibly even both. But it's not going to happen unless you and I get involved, actually get out there and get active. I'm speaking at a Democratic Party fundraiser here in Washington County this weekend, for example. and you know, and help out the Greens and the Libertarians, and for that matter, join the Republican Party. Participate.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where smart people get their news. Welcome back to our program. Jeff Ziegler is with us. Is it Ziegler or Ziegler, Jeff?
You got it right. Ziegler is fine.
Ziegler, okay. Jeff Ziegler is the president of the Continental Group and government relations director of Operation White Coat. Your website, is it myriadhealth.com?
That's correct.
As in M-Y-R-I-A-D, health.com. And, Jeff, you suggest that you have... Well, first of all, what is Operation White Coat?
Operation White Coat was founded 18 months ago. It is an alliance of doctors that advocate... on a number of issues on the social side, pro-life advocacy, looking for new breakthroughs in medicine, trying to get government out of the healthcare business. But also, probably the largest thing that we've been undertaking is developing the technology and business techniques to begin to downsize and eventually privatize the Medicare system.
Okay, well, interesting. Lots for us to talk about. First of all, let's start out with the pro-life work that you're doing and trying to get the government out of medicine. How could it be? It seems to me like there's a contradiction in terms. If you're going to criminalize abortions, how is that getting the government out of medicine?
Well, again, we're talking about broad strokes in terms of how we view medicine. Medicine has to be decoupled from government. And there's two things you're looking at there, the litigious side, which is dealing with Roe v. Wade and et cetera, and the actual doing the business side of medicine. Right now, government makes up 50% of the entire healthcare market. What that means is you have an effective monopoly, and that drives prices, policies, and so on across the board. If we start removing government from the healthcare economy, now you see prices begin to come into some realistic market.
Well, let's get into that conversation in just a second. But I'd like to just for a moment here stay with this question. I still am baffled.
I'm getting to it.
Okay.
But see, understand, they write the rules, but the rules are based on money. So you've got to back them out as a percentage.
So the abortion rules are based on money.
Absolutely, it's all economics.
I fail to understand. If a woman becomes, say a woman is raped and she becomes pregnant and she wants to get an abortion, why is that an economic decision?
There's profit in abortion.
Well, right? there's profit, and there's profit in all medical procedures. Are you not in favor?
Actually, that's not true. But,
okay, well, broadly speaking.
But the issue is...
First of all, are you not in favor of medicine being profitable?
Absolutely.
Okay, so what's wrong with there being profit in abortion?
Because it is antithetical to what medicine is to be, which is health care, saving lives, not state-sanctioned murder.
So if a woman's life is in danger, then you think she should be allowed to have an abortion, but otherwise not?
There are very rare circumstances wherein a
Those are the ones I'm talking about.
Well, it's still not an issue to be adjudicated. It is an issue that each state's going to have to take up, which if we throw down Roe v. Wade, that's exactly what's going to happen.
So you think that if a woman becomes pregnant and if she carries that baby to term, she will die, that's okay with you?
It's not an issue of what I think. It's a question of what she's going to be having to deliberate in that circumstance.
So then you think she should have a choice? She should have a choice of whether to abort the fetus and live or whether not to abort the fetus and die.
In this country, the baby was saved first. period.
Traditionally, historically, because women were considered the property of men, and this is my child, and so if my wife dies, I'll still have my child, right?
No.
I mean, you're talking about traditionally,
contrary,
you're talking about the 6,000 years of the history of
on
men.
On the contrary, okay. On the contrary, we were a futuristic country, and therefore we put everything into the future, i.e. the children and the next generation, not worrying about the present tense. And so the question really comes down to, would you sacrifice your life for your child? And at what point is it your child? Well, I don't know about
you. I don't disagree with you that there are some people who would probably make that decision. But really the question comes down to, should the government, with the power of guns and jail cells, be making that decision for you? And it sounds to me like you're in favor of that, and I don't understand why, when you're in favor of the government being involved in these kinds of medical decisions, you're saying that you're in favor of getting the government out of medicine. I don't get it.
Abortion is not medicine.
Okay, so that's your definition.
Killing.
Okay, so we'll just leave that at that. I don't think we can go any farther than that.
Well, the Hippocratic Oath defines medicine in terms of how the modern American medical industry / profession evolved and grew.
Well, see, here's Jeff Ziegler. This is Jeff Ziegler's website, by the way, myriadhealth.com. You know, where it's going to break down on this between you and me, Jeff, is when life begins, because you're suggesting that all abortion is murder. And I'm of the opinion, frankly, that if you've got a collection of 50 or 100 cells in a woman's uterus, or actually probably in her fallopian tubes or in her uterus, that's not yet human life. I agree with the old biblical definitions, frankly. I agree with where the Catholic Church was at in 1859 when they said life didn't, you know, you didn't have viable human life until at least the 15th week or thereabouts.
I would say that medical technology has advanced a little bit beyond 1859, wherein we can see that life does begin before. But really, I'm not talking about all abortion being murder. Listen to what I'm saying very carefully. State-sanctioned, state-sponsored. That's a big difference. When the state is involved in the actual sponsoring of, promotion of, it's not just a question of legalization.
Well, in this, I think you're absolutely consistent, because you're opposed to the state being involved in sanctioning or sponsoring any kind of medicine, are you not? Really, you think the entire thing should be privatized?
Again, we'll try this one more time. State-sanctioned, state-sponsored. That means the state paying for the actual killing of the babies.
Right, but I'm saying let's even expand that. This is I think that you're making a point that is consistent with your second point. See, what I was confused by was this inconsistency of, on the one hand, you were saying you were in favor of getting government out of our medical decisions, unless it has to do with abortion, in which case you want somebody with a gun to show up at my house, and then on the other hand, you were saying let's get government out of medicine, let's get government, let's privatize Medicare basically.
Well, again,
it sounds to me like if you're saying
it's not an inconsistency. An argument, because you are on two different tracks. There is
right.
an economic issue and there's a law-based issue. And
right, I understand. I understand. I understand. I'm not disagreeing with you on that.
Okay.
So let's talk about the Medicare part of it.
Right.
You're suggesting that if we were to privatize Medicare and just do away with Medicare and Medicaid and have the government be paying no part of anybody's health care bills, that would be a good thing in the United States. Am I
not
oversimplifying?
Quite. Not quite. This is how it would work. The issue at hand is the cost of health care, period. Whether you want to talk about Medicare, Medicaid, what you pay, what your doctors pay in medical malpractice, whatever, the cost of health care is going up, not down, and has been over the last 15 to 25 years. Now, why? That's the question. And what has happened is with the aging population, the growth of the Medicare program, in concert with that aging population, you're now at a point where the federal government is actually controlling, through actual transactions, 49 to 50% of all health care in the United States.
Sure.
Secondly.
What's wrong with that?
Well, I'll tell you in a minute. Secondly, they write the rules for the private side. So, in effect, what you have is...
They write the rules by virtue of what they'll pay for and what they won't pay for. Is that what you're talking about?
No, it's more than that. It's also through regulations. But, again, for example, what's HIPAA? HIPAA compliance. Those are all government regulations.
Mm-hmm.
Medicare regulations alone would fill 25,000 volumes of an encyclopedia. That's how many regs we have.
Yeah, it's not unlike the so-called free trade regulations, the World Trade Organization.
Exactly.
But you know, I'm not in disagreement with you that perhaps the system could be streamlined. But, Jeff, let me just toss one thing out here and get your feedback on this. Medicare right now is delivering health care at a cost of about 2%. About $2 out of every $100 that goes through Medicare sticks to the fingers of administration. It's the cost of administration.
Not at all, and I'll tell you why that's
well, this is according to the Government Accountability Office. I mean, this is a nonpartisan.
But this is how they get around that. They work through intermediaries that have contracted with Medicare that add an additional 35 to 40% administrative costs.
Right, and those are the private for-profit companies. And just like private for-profit health insurance companies are taking 15, 20, 25, 30% off the top, I don't get it how having a for-profit. And, Jeff, we've got to take a break. Can you stick around and we can continue this conversation?
Yeah, and we'll answer that question. It's actually pretty simple.
Yeah, because I think this is one of the big issues of our day, that we really have to figure out how are we going to have a healthcare system that actually can serve the needs of Americans and, you know, not break the bank, whether it's the government's bank or whether it's your bank. We're talking with Jeff Ziegler of MyriadHealth.com. He's with the Continental Group and Government Relations Director for Operation White Coat. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartmann Radio Program.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartmann.
If you knew that you would die today, you saw the face of God and love, would you change? Would you change?
And welcome back, my friends. 21 and a half minutes past the hour, we're talking with Jeff Ziegler of MyriadHealth.com. Jeff, a compulsory pregnancy advocate in my world. You wouldn't describe yourself that way, Jeff.
Probably not, unless the woman wanted to. So, you know, be fruitful and multiply, right?
Well, you know, I'd say it's gotten us into some big trouble. It was probably good advice 6,000 years ago when it was a few small tribes warring against each other over a small amount of resources in the Middle East. But right now we've got 6 billion of us on this planet. Doesn't seem like a good idea. But well, in any case, we've had that discussion. We're not.
We did.
Other than just one real quick question. I'm just wondering if abortion is murder. And if I hire somebody to kill somebody, then I'm guilty of murder as well, and I can be put to death, as we just saw recently with Scott, what's-his-name, you know, the guy in California who had his wife killed, or who killed his wife, Scott Peterson, or, you know, the charges that were made against Robert Blakely. So if a woman decides to have an abortion, should she be given lethal injection? Should she be hung? Should she be, you know, what form of execution should she receive for that murder?
Actually, I think the actual executioner should be held accountable. So in that case, it would be the doctor.
So if I hire somebody to kill
the victim as the child.
So if I hire somebody to kill you, Jeff, then you and I are both victims, and the guy who kills you is the one who goes to jail?
Not quite the same.
Why not?
Because in most cases, the woman in, for example, in the case of abortion, is not consciously going in to say, I think what I'll do today is kill my child. It is.
She is if she's heard you on the radio.
Well, I kind of doubt that in that most women that have abortions, and statistics prove this, don't think that you have a viable entity. And
yeah.
You kind of alluded to that before about your 15 weeks idea.
Yeah, okay, so we're getting back to the circular logic here, the argument about when
exactly.
A fetus is viable, when is human life viable.
It's the foundational presupposition. You always come back to that.
Yeah, there you go. So anyhow, let's get back to this thing about Medicaid, and we're going to have to do this fairly quickly. We only have about five minutes left in this segment, so I do want to I'm trying to understand this.
Where you have risk bearers in what I call an incest relationship with government doesn't work. It only adds a later layer of administration. About 35 to 40% more cost to do it that way. So the best way to do it is to remove the risk bearer. Because the insurance companies are killing the government, killing the healthcare economy and being bad with these capitated rates.
So you're saying let's get rid of all the health insurance companies?
No, here's what you do. You change the way to do business. That's done not through policy, it's done through technology. What happens right now, and here's the main reason why all medicine costs so much. You have the government coming in with Medicare, Medicaid, whatever, and saying, here's the deliverable services, You guys administrate it. They pad the cost. They drill down on the doctors. They don't pay them for 180 days.
They do all this stuff because they're for-profit corporations, and their first purpose of existence is to make a profit. Their second purpose is to deliver health care, right?
Correct, but let me qualify that. I'm no defender of insurance companies. They sit on their float for 180 days. They invest that. They make money.
Sure. I mean, that's their mandate.
There's another way of doing it. And it's a way that it should.
Yeah, why not make them nonprofit?
Well, because there's another way to make it profitable, and everybody wins. What if you turn your insurance company into a bank? Now, when you go make a deposit in your bank, how long does your bank hold it before you can withdraw it?
I don't know.
A day?
I don't have any idea. I've never tried to take money out of a bank immediately after I put it in. I don't have any idea.
It's 24 hours.
I'm assuming it's until, you know, the check is cleared, whatever that is.
It's 24 hours.
Yeah, okay.
And so what you do, you turn the insurance company into someone that moves cash instead of sitting on it.
So you're going back to kind of George Bush's idea of health savings accounts. You're saying that basically we should all have savings accounts, and if we get sick, we should draw down from our savings accounts. Is that it?
A health savings account has a certain benefit. It's a choice people make, but that's not what I'm talking about. What I'm saying is, in Medicare, you wanted to deliver a vehicle wherein your intermediary, your insurance company, whatever you want to call it, a PPL, whatever, is going to move the money right through the system in 24 hours. The doc gets paid in 24 hours. The claim is adjudicated. Boom. What does that mean?
How does
real
that?
Terms?
You know, I understand that you might have some saving there, Jeff, if people can't make money off their money. We have less than a minute here. I don't understand, though, why, if you've got a corporation that's main purpose is to make money,
They'll make money in that 24 hours. They won't need it for 180 days.
Okay, so, but you're going to have to do that by government regulation. I thought you wanted to get government out of this.
At first, yes, because when you're talking about decoupling a major economic system from government, it's not going to be done just by allowing it to crash.
And then after that, you're just going to hope that they'll be nice enough to hold our money just for 24 hours?
Actually, the technology that's been developed will demand it to be so. And don't get me wrong. Government will not disappear in this area. It's going to be reduced to about 25% of the market from 50% now. And what that's going to allow things to happen is real market forces develop and prices go down, not up.
Yeah, well, it sounds to me like a nice fantasy, but the reality, in my experience, is that for-profit corporations are always looking for a way to make a profit, and non-profit corporations.
Not evil. It's just how it's done.
I'm not saying they are. I run one, but non-profit corporations, and I also run one of those, or I'm on the board of one, are designed to do a particular purpose, like deliver health care, and that's the first thing they do. But anyhow, we'll let our listeners, they can check out your website, myriadhealth.com. Jeff Ziegler, cool. Thanks for being with us, Jeff. 27 minutes past the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
You gave him the old, stay the course, I'm your man. Why, he'll flip-flop ya. He has no strength to lead. Yes, this you feared. Why, soldiers' jobs and surplus disappeared. Gave him the old, never yet devil speak. Yes, with folks swindled him. No one could hear the truth above the roar. And though your debating was a stinker, they bought it all, hook, line, and sinker. You razzle-dazzled him, and they gave you four more.
Too many OBGYNs aren't able to practice their love with women all across this country.
I hear there's rumors on the internets. You cannot lead if you send mixed messages.
And let's never forget about those mixed messages. Welcome back, my friend. That, by the way, people are always sending me notes. Who does that soundtrack from Chicago imitation? There's a couple of songs there that, razzle dazzle so well. It's Bill Jacobs. BillJacobs.us is his website, and the music is right there for free if you want to listen to it. You can download it, iPod it, put it on your computer, whatever you'd like. Bill Jacobs, a very, very, very talented guy. Just absolutely brilliant. Well, never let it be said. By the way, welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, 36 minutes past the hour. And our program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS. Never let it be said that I have not really tried to give a conservative an opportunity to make sense on this program. You know, for a half hour, it's like, what are you talking about? I don't understand this. I still don't understand. I'm sorry. What can I say? I'm sure Jeff Ziegler has a program that makes sense to him, and he's, you know, trying to market it, in fact. But the bottom line for me is, for example, I'll just give you a real-life example. I'm involved in a couple of businesses. One of them is this radio show. This is a for-profit business. If people advertise on the program and people buy their products and all that kind of thing, you know, maybe someday I can make some money, or as it were. Wouldn't that be nice? And you know, it's a for-profit business. So my goal, of course, is to deliver as good a product as I can, a radio show, an interesting radio show that will be of value to people, that they can find of value, and that's going to be strong enough that they'll listen over the commercial breaks, listen to the sponsors, respond to the sponsors, buy their products, and the radio stations will keep me on the air, put me on more, you know, stations and that kind of thing, and the sponsors will pay me. Okay, so, and your local sponsors, of course, are paying your local radio stations, and that makes them happy, so they keep the program on the air. So that's the goal of a for-profit corporation, is to make some money. You deliver a product, in this case a radio show, but really, you know, I want to make a living at this. And so, you know, that's why I'm doing it. And in fact, now I am making a living. It's kind of a cool thing. On the other hand, I'm also the president of the board of directors of a nonprofit, of two nonprofits, actually, the New England-Salem Children's Village and the Hunter School. They're both in New Hampshire. They both are programs that actually my wife and I started. We started the Community for Abused Kids, New England-Salem Children's Trust, 28 years ago. In Rumney, New Hampshire, and we started the school about 8 or 9 years ago now, the Hunter School for ADHD Kids. They're both not-for-profits, and I'm the president of the board of the directors of both of these organizations, have been for, you know, decades with on and off. We trade around, but I've been on the board for all these years. I don't take a paycheck for that. All of the board members serve for free. This is community service. I get no money out of it. In fact, when I go out to New Hampshire, you know, a couple times a year for the board meetings, I pay my own way. I don't get reimbursed for it. And why? Because that organization was created, those organizations were created to do a particular purpose. One is created to educate kids, and the other is created to take care of kids for whom there's nobody to take care of. You know, kids who have been so severely damaged in the system. Basically, they're too badly damaged for foster care, and they're not sufficiently psychotic to be in the state mental hospital or in the criminal justice system. And so, you know, it's providing care to these kids, and it's very straightforward. And so, every dollar that goes into the program has to be accounted in the context of, is this dollar helping serve these children? Pure and simple, because that's the purpose of those organizations. Whereas every dollar that comes into this radio show, ultimately, it being a for-profit business, has to be rationalized in the context of, is this helping this radio show ultimately be more profitable? Just like with any business. And so now you look at healthcare for a moment and you say, do we want a healthcare system in the United States, like every other industrialized country in the world, that is not for profit? Whether it's a single-payer system like they have in Germany, or whether it's a socialized medicine like they have in England, or to use American examples, whether it's a single-payer system like we have with Medicare, or whether it's a socialized program where the government actually owns the hospitals and the doctors are employees of the government, like we have with the Veterans Administration. We have both in the United States, by the way. But in both cases, they're not-for-profit organizations. Or do we want to have, unlike every other, you know, fully developed democracy in the world, do we want to have a for-profit healthcare system where, in addition to providing healthcare, every dollar that goes through the system has to be thought of in terms of how is this going to maximize profit? Because at some point we want to be able to write a dividend check to the stockholders. We want to pay a salary to the CEOs. We want to have the corporate jet. We want to have the corporate headquarters. We want to have, you know, if you're a healthcare company, obviously, I'll tell you, this radio show anyway doesn't have that kind of budget, but maybe Rush does. But in any case, I suppose I can dream. But the point is, every dollar that goes through a for-profit company, even a health insurance company, even a health providing company, you know, one of two things. The decisions are going to be made based on one of two very simple criteria based on the corporate structure. Is it a nonprofit corporation or is it a for-profit corporation? And those the question is going to be, is this dollar going to be used to maximize profit or is this dollar going to be used to deliver health care? And all of these conservative schemes, and there's a whole bunch of them out there, and Jeff may have a really cool one. I mean, I never did quite understand it, but he may have a real cool one. But all of these conservative schemes basically are trying to figure out ways to deliver health care and be sure that people make a profit. And I'm saying, and I've been saying for a long, long time in this, I'd rather have the people who are providing health care to me be concerned about providing health care than be concerned about how much money they're making. I think that they should make a good living. I have no, you know, I have no problem with that. When I lived in Germany, I, you know, actually a program that I worked with, Eugen and Hilfsrecht Solom, this international relief agency, had a clinic right there in Germany. We had a doctor, Dr. Geert, Dr. Oslein Geert, who was a good friend of mine for many years, still is. I haven't seen him in a couple of years, but assuming, you know, he's still around. He made a salary that was probably the equivalent in U.S. dollars today of around $160,000 a year, which was very, very good money for rural Germany. It wasn't, he didn't get rich, but he made a really good salary. And nobody begrudged him that. I mean, you know, 8 years of medical school and all this stuff and putting up with, you know, patients and everything else. And in England, you know, I've used the medical care system there, at least one of my children has. And, you know, doctors are well paid. They're not getting rich, but they're well paid. I got no problem with that. So I don't, you know, I don't want people to worry about where the next meal is coming from. But, you know, the whole idea that there are people, and a dear friend of mine, Louis Melmadrona, who wrote Coyote Medicine, he's a physician and now he's a professor of medicine, once made the comment to me that it horrified him how many medical students he had in his classes who were right up front about the fact that they went into medicine because they wanted to make money. And they were therefore choosing subspecialties or specialties where they could make the most profit, like oncology or plastic surgery, rather than the areas where there was actually a need, like general practice or pediatrics or obstetrics or emergency medicine. So, you know, it's just, you know, what kind of system do we want to have? And I think, you know, in my mind, it's just... You know, it's not a matter of, you know, how cool is the software. It's a matter of how is the system structured. It's a structural thing. And I think the solution is so simple here in the United States. The solution is so simple. We know right now that the average American who has health insurance, which keep in mind is only about 60% of us, but the average American who has health insurance is paying about $10,300 a year for that health insurance. They may not be paying it all out of their own pocket. In fact, most of them aren't. Their employers are paying for it. But if their employers weren't, and this is the same argument that's made about taxes, if their employers weren't paying it, if it wasn't being paid somehow, their paycheck could go up. So we have, you know, 60% of us are paying around $10,300 a year for health insurance right now in the United States. It's going up around 14 to 17% a year. If we were to take Medicare, which is delivered at the cost of 2 to 3%, as opposed to private health insurance, which is delivered at a cost of around 25 to 30%, because you got to skim that money off the top to pay dividends and to pay the CEO and the corporate jet and everything. If we were to simply say, everybody in America is now eligible for Medicare, period. Just like in Germany, just like in Canada, everybody in the country is eligible for Medicare. You get a card, you get a number, you can walk into any doctor's office, any hospital. Private doctors, private hospitals, they can still do, you know, however they want, you know, within reasonable limits. What we would see is that all of our taxes would go up about $3,000 a year. But 60% of us would pay $10,300 a year less. So basically, working people would see an increase in their paycheck. You know, a few people would be paying a little more in taxes. And we would have a healthcare system that would provide for all. And it just makes sense to me. Let's go to a single-payer healthcare system. Let's just say, it's just so simple. We have Medicare. This is, by the way, the reason why the Republicans are trying to destroy Medicare. This is why they put that poison pill in there of the prescription drug benefit that said that by law, Medicare cannot negotiate with the pharmaceutical companies for discounts on drugs. Reason why? Very simply, they wanted to bankrupt the Medicare system. Why do they want to bankrupt it? Because they want to get rid of it. Why do they want to get rid of it? Because it is a single-payer health care system that is already providing health care to a good chunk of the population of the United States, maybe 15-20% thereabouts. And, you know, heaven forbid that somebody might come along like me and say, hey, why don't we just have this apply to everybody? 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program.
Yes, welcome back. I remember all those many months Louise and I were hanging around in various Caribbean islands and drinking far too much rum. Welcome back. Hey, thank you. 50 minutes past the hour, 9 minutes before the top of the hour. Just a quick reminder, tonight on public broadcasting, check your local listings because it varies from city to city and public broadcasting station to public broadcasting station. I know, for example, in Lansing, Michigan, it's not playing until Friday, but on most stations around the country, tonight there will be a program called Global Warming, the Signs and the Science, narrated by Alanis Morissette, and reading from the promo that public broadcasting sent out on this, and I quote, filmed in the U.S., Asia, and South America, this wide-ranging, compelling, and accessible program brings the reality of climate change to life and offers viewers inspiring examples of people making a difference in their own community. The program features numerous science experts, including Tom Hartman, author of The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight and host of Air America's The Tom Hartman Program. They review a growing body of evidence of the grave consequences of a changing climate and explore how individuals, communities, and organizations across America are creating new approaches to safeguard future generations. So check your listings. It'll be on your public broadcasting station, your PBS TV station, in all probability at 8 o'clock local time tonight. Although, as I said, it may vary. The program is called Global Warming, the Signs and the Science. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466. Spike in Easton, Pennsylvania. Hey, Spike, how you doing?
Hey, Gonzo greetings. Long time no speak.
Yeah, indeed. And thanks for holding while I went through that whole rant there. What's up?
Not much. I've been hold for about an hour now. Two things real quick. One is I heard a great interview with someone from World Can't Wait on the All Things Reconsidered show, which is actually done by the chat room's own Zapper for Prez, and anyone can listen to the archive of that at whiterosesociety.org.
Cool.
And the other is when the Democrats finally got a pair yesterday to finally stand up to the Republican war machine, and while I admit that's great to see Reid and his little prison wife Santorum there, you know, be put in their place as the crybabies they are, and for what they've done to this country by creating state-sponsored mass execution of well over 100,000 human beings, I certainly hope that now that the light's on and the war-monging cockroaches are running, that the Democratic Party also doesn't forget the people on the inside of their own party who some to this day still continue to support this debacle in Iraq, including people like Hillary Clinton and, of course, the neoconservative, all Democratic neoconservative, Joe Lieberman.
Yeah. No, I'm right there with you, Spike, and, you know, thanks for the call and making the point. We do need to hold the Democrats accountable for these things as well. Sue in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Sue, what's up?
Hi. Hi, Tom. Well, I guess I finally got up the guts to call. It's the first time I've ever called you, but I just had to call today after listening to the conversations over the last few days about abortion and health care and everything else. First, I would agree with the last caller. It burns me up to hear conservatives talk about not wanting to support state-sponsored murder when I just read the ticker about $212-some-odd billion that we spent sponsoring the murder of innocent people in Iraq. It just seems very inconsistent right there to me.
Well, not to mention capital punishment. I mean, they're usually in favor of that, too. But hypocrisy doesn't seem to have ever been a huge problem for the Republican Party, for some in the Democratic Party either. I mean, let's be nonpartisan about this.
Right.
In any case, yeah, okay. Good point,
also,
Sue.
And also, I would say, you know, one thing that I think that people really may not understand, we've been talking about the issue of abortion and spousal notification, and someone who actually went through an experience like that myself, I know that it is not an uncommon experience for people who are victims of spousal abuse to be in a situation where they're pregnant. And Jeff Ziegler may not understand that there may be other children involved. There may be, you know, it's not just the life of the mother. There's other people's lives at stake.
Yeah, I have heard, pardon my interrupting you, I've gotten a startling number of emails from women who have said that their experience has been that rape with the purpose of fertilization is a tool that abusive husbands use against wives, and I'd heard that, but boy, it's apparently quite widespread.
Yeah, it's not a 0.1% or what some of these folks are saying. It is extremely common and an extremely scary experience, and I think that in my experience working with battered women, it's something more in the range of 25% have been through that kind of an experience.
Oh, my goodness.
And I'd also like to say something about Medicare and, what the situation with Medicare and folks like Mr. Ziegler. I understand a lot of conservatives want to see people like Terry Schiavo maintain forever and, at the whoever's expense this is, and what happens in the case of Terry Schiavo, what happens in the case of so many people. My mother's in an Alzheimer's facility right now. She's getting very good care on the Medicaid program. There's absolutely no way that we could afford the cost of her care if we didn't have that support. And
right, but you're not a Republican multimillionaire, Sue.
Pardon?
You have to understand, you're not a multimillionaire Republican or one of the many Republicans in America who expects that because of George Bush's wonderful policies, they will be a multimillionaire by the time they retire.
Right.
Who has drunk the Kool-Aid and thought, well, if I just have that privatized Social Security, I'll be able to take my $300 a month contribution into Social Security or whatever it is, and it'll be worth hundreds of thousands, millions by the time I retire.
Yeah, no problem.
The wonders of Wall Street.
$5,000 a month nursing home facility costs, no problem.
Yeah.
And that's what I think these folks just don't understand. I mean, the one of the issues that is bankrupting Medicare is the cost of treating Medicare patients and also Alzheimer's patients and also just the incredible cost of prescription drugs. I know I worked in mental health for a long time, and basically
the Oregon
health plan is being decimated by...
Right. Sue, I'm sorry we're out of time. I gotta thank you for the call and for your comments, and you're spot on. By the way, tomorrow I'm going to be debating two conservatives, Francis B. Smith, adjunct fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, about agricultural spending interests and the effect on trade liberalization, and good old Dick Morris on his book about Condi versus Hillary. That should be entertaining. Check out the program tomorrow. It's 57 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Thanks for being with us today. We'll see you again tomorrow, same time, same place. Don't forget, 8 o'clock tonight, in all probability, on PBS. Check out that TV show, Global Warming. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.